Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Anna Lida. She's the director of the IHEU Ipignani Humanist Center for Bioethics, and we'll tease all that apart in a second.
Ipignani.
Welcome, Anna.
Thank you.
It's very nice to have you. Now, Anna, you are originally Romanian, so let's start there. You started as a musician in Romania?
Yes, I studied for 12 years. Classical music.
Which, under the former Eastern Bloc regimes, that was going to be a pretty prestigious career.
Yes, but I didn't get that.
You didn't end up in the state orchestra, huh?
No, and I will explain why not.
Okay, what happened?
Okay, I've been exposed to classical music at the age of 10. And later on, one of my instructors in primary school actually noticed my talent for music, and I was enrolled in a school of arts, being trained in theory of music, history of music, clarinet, and piano. And of course, I loved those years, and I thought I would become a musician. But life is full of surprises. Being in a music high school, I discovered philosophy as a taught discipline, as it was compulsory for us to take it. So I used to love the nature of such discourse and simply kept on reading. But again, I wouldn't have never thought that time to become a teacher of philosophy, because music was my vocation. As I failed to get into the Academy of Music, I had philosophy as a second chance. And of course, without much speculation, I guess both philosophy and music have something in common, to say the least. Neither philosophy nor music could be studied without being passionately about, and both of them take time and energy in an isolation with yourself. And then more than it, music theory is entirely based on logic, mathematics, and physics, yet its aesthetic appeal is pure emotional. Now, there are people, and my colleagues maybe would argue with me, because I'm in the United States, that philosophy is not art. True. Philosophy is rigorous. It implies logical abstract thinking, and the world of ideas is not very easy to grasp, as we know. It is thinking about thinking. But aesthetics is related to art, as is dealing with artistic values. And again, I discovered aesthetics as a branch of philosophy in high school.
You saw the connection. I guess that's a point in a Socratic or Platonic philosophy, that there is a fundamental connection between aesthetics and ethics, right?
That's right.
Who is it, Socrates or Plato?
Well, actually, the one who said that is Plato. Yeah. But later on, there is a 20th century philosopher, Wittgenstein, who said that aesthetics and ethics are but one,
yeah,
because they are both part of axiology, theory of values.
Uh-huh.
One is dealing with moral values, the other one is dealing with artistic values.
That's very interesting. We'll come back to that when we talk about the yuck factor in bioethics, I think, because that's an interesting point. Okay, so how did you end up in Lincoln, Missouri? If I was coming from Bucharest, I don't think I would have immediately gone to Lincoln, Missouri. Maybe too similar in some ways.
Well, not necessarily, but I did not go directly to Lincoln, Missouri. From Bucharest, I was accepted in a master's degree program at Bowling Green State University, and then I passed a prelim examination for a PhD. So after finishing my studies at Bowling Green State in Ohio, Department of Philosophy, immediately I got this tenure track position at Lincoln University, Missouri. So I held the position for 3 years there, and I resigned because I wanted very much to work in the field of bioethics, in the field of bioethics at the UN.
Well, that's where we end up now. You're the director of the IHEU Apignani Humanist Center for Bioethics at the UN.
Yeah.
And Mr. Apignani gave the money to the IHEU to create this center. And you gave up a tenure-track job to go and work at the UN on this project. So you must really feel passionate that there are some important issues being discussed at the UN on the bioethics front.
Correct.
So what are they?
Correct. So there are, why am I passionate about the center? Here's the answer. The center's mission is reflected in the belief that a moral framework based on science and rationality rather than faith will promote human values such as freedom, self-determination, responsibility, and solidarity, avoiding any authoritarian appeal. Now, most humanist bioethics believe that ethical reasoning must hold beyond the framework of any particular religious belief, founded on the convictions that there can be no peace without the intellectual and moral solidarity of humankind. The center is dealing with the following bioethical issues at the international level: stem cell research, human cloning, human and food genetic engineering, and related issues of AIDS epidemic and abortion in the light of recent scientific developments and their far-reaching global impact.
Well, those are some excellent issues. Of course, issues very close to my heart. You've written some things online about the forces that are active in the UN and in countries around the world that you see as the humanist movement needing to counter or to react to. And you've laid about as three principal groups: the authoritarian religious influence, the new romanticism, and unaccountable corporate power. And I think it's very interesting, this tripartite framework, because I see new romanticism, as you framed it, as being very influential in a lot of humanist thinking. Isn't this one of the issues, is to confront the influence of romantic thinking within humanism?
Yes, of course, because romanticism actually is more related, what I wanted to say that in the interview, to the European view. And they seem to be afraid of food genetic engineering, not to say anything of human genetic engineering. And are we talking about the Luddism?
Right, Luddites.
We call them Luddites. Yeah, these are bioconservatives.
Right, I like that term better too.
And I think bioconservatives should be the term that we can use, because people are not very familiar with Luddites.
Or new romanticism.
But actually, new romantics are bioconservatives. And we know that there are lots of articles not only arguing on, not only arguing using as a ground their religious beliefs, but some people are simply against food genetic engineering in Europe. And this cannot solve the problem of hunger in the third world.
Again, I'm talking with Anna Lita. She's the director of the IHEU Apignani Humanist Center for Bioethics. And the IHEU is the International Humanist and Ethical Union, which represents humanist, free thought, and atheist organizations around the world. And Anna works at the UN on these issues. And so, obviously, the UN must be riven with debates about the, the WHO has been very involved in the promotion of technology transfer to the developing world and international technology policy. So this issue about genetically modified food and how we're going to feed the growing numbers of billions in the world must be pretty central to the UN's concerns.
Yes, it is.
And so you've been active in some of that and trying to network with the groups around that?
Not yet, because we are at a stage of writing some policy statements. IAGU is supposed to write some policy statements, and then they will circulate around other NGOs, and we will have the chance to present that during a briefing and to see what is the feedback we get.
Well, I think it's very important, as you've pointed out, the unaccountable corporate power be included as a part of the discussion, because one of the concerns of the New Romantics that I'm very sympathetic with is that we need to have more of a democratic policy and democratic set of concerns in all of these debates from human biotechnology and animal and plant biotechnology.
I think it's a problem of intellectual property.
Yeah, intellectual property especially.
So
does IHEU have a position on, for instance, gene patenting, human gene patenting?
Not yet, but we are working on that.
Yeah, you should mention you've got a conference coming up in New York in, what, March?
Yes, no. The conference, it's an inaugural conference of our center, and everybody is welcome. It will be held at the United Nations on 777 Plaza on April 22nd and 23rd, 2005. And we are ambitious because we would like to invite people from various fields, leading humanists, bioethicists, biologists, people involved in biotechnology, practitioners, and of course students. And the conference is in its intent multidisciplinary. We invite papers on all the issues mentioned before, but also, and this is maybe something new, although I'm not very familiar with what happened at the UN, but I venture to say that it's new as a topic. A topic which is on genetic engineering and post-humanism.
Excellent.
these terms, I'm sure they are not very known by the public, the terms transhuman and post-human. Therefore, they seem to be controversial. However, it is my opinion that although controversial, transhumanism is the idea that humans can use reason to transcend the human condition limitations through genetic engineering and body enhancement. Transhumanists, in general, they see genetic engineering as offering an impressive future for humankind, although some of the outcomes of genetic engineering are, of course, unpredictable, at least at this hour, or at this initial stage of its technological development.
You know, Anna, that there is actually some of the bioconservatives have an anti-transhumanist agenda. There's a group called the Center for Genetics and Society and the bioethicist George Annis, who would like to see an international treaty forbidding all technologies which have species-altering consequences for human beings. And that would include inheritable genetic modification. But some of them would like to go so far as to ban things like prosthetic limbs and, you know, artificial hearts and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, we mentioned earlier the New Romanticism. I think it's not just Europe where we see secular, progressive, left-wing people who have adopted some kind of quasi-mystical notion that humanness itself is some kind of ideal that needs to be protected.
Well, we also have to mention, related to that, the Food and Drug Administration, which forbids genetic modification, enhancement,
right,
so-called gene therapy for both enhancements and correcting genetic defects.
Our National Institutes for Health refuses to allow clinical trials.
That's right. As the speculation goes that scientists can never understand genome well enough to avoid unintended consequences for future generations.
Which is, you know, that's true of almost all medicine, that we, you know, aspirin, if we had tried to wait to understand all the consequences of aspirin before allowing people to use it, would have been a very long time.
That's right.
Yeah.
But We welcome at this inaugural conference transhumanists. And, of course, we hope that the public will understand better what transhumanism is all about, because, in general, it's associated with a brave new world, with a world of fiction, with fiction novels, and so on. And I think we should avoid this kind of misunderstanding of what actually transhumanism is about.
Absolutely. Especially since Brave New World wasn't that bad a place. I mean, they did have free drugs and free sex, so...
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And maybe I should mention another topic, which I think is not very much discussed at the United Nations. It's organ markets.
Ah.
Recent developments in immunosuppressive drugs and improved surgical techniques have now made it much easier successfully to transplant organs from one human body to another. But unfortunately, in the eyes of the public or in the eyes of many, these developments have led to the development of black markets in human organs, with people who need, for example, kidneys to survive or to improve the quality of their lives, purchasing such organs from impoverished persons in the developing world. India is one of the examples. Eastern Europe, Turkey, I've seen an article last week about Turkish people selling their kidneys very cheaply. Given the increasing need for transplant organs, should such markets be regulated and legalized? This is a question that the United Nations has not dealt with by now.
Absolutely.
Or could the success of therapeutic cloning eliminate the need to consider this option?
Right, stem cells or artificial
organs.
They are
related.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, the issue of organ markets raises, I think, one of the important contributions of humanists to this debate, which is that with anything having to do with the embryo or organs, people get a yucky reaction. They have a visceral reaction that there's something wrong with mucking around with the body like that, just like people used to have that reaction to autopsies. Autopsies used to be illegal. So in the United States, we call this yuck factor bioethics, and the president's bioethics advisor, Leon Kass, is the chief advocate of yuck factor bioethics, which he calls the wisdom of repugnance. And it seems like this would be one of the chief places where humanists need to say, no, you know, reason has its role in modulating and figuring out what's good and what's bad.
And they do say so, but not in a united kind of voice. So I do hope that those who will participate in our conference, because we will also try to publish the papers, they will more or less convince the public of the importance of embryonic stem cell research and, of course, including markets for organs.
So let's go back a sec, because you actually have written about Iris Murdoch, and I was curious what your interest was in Iris Murdoch. I know her principally as a novelist, but you've been writing about her philosophical work.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Yes. In my dissertation, I was comparing two philosophers' friends. Both they were trained at Oxford, and they were teaching for a while there, Iris Murdoch and Philippa Foot. Iris Murdoch is very well known as a novelist, especially in Great Britain, but not as a philosopher. Philippa Foot is well known in the United States because she was teaching here too, as an Oxford type of philosopher, analytical, therefore. Now, when I met Philippa Foot, I was absolutely surprised because these two persons were friends the whole life, And yet Philippa wouldn't consider Iris a philosopher. And I felt obliged to add that, well, maybe not a philosopher in that tradition. Actually, Iris Murdoch is a Neoplatonist. Why I was interested in Iris? Simply because when you write a dissertation, you need to write to choose a topic which is more or less unique. And Iris, in general, is difficult to read, is difficult to interpret, because the way she writes, she has a collection of essays, is, in a sense, also literary. The topics are entirely philosophical, but the style of writing, of course, has the mark of a novelist. And I got caught by that style, probably because I came from, I was trained in Europe, and mainly there we were training continental philosophy, not necessarily analytical. Well, with logic, but continental philosophy. Now, Iris has something unique to say in her philosophy. My topic was about the moral self or moral person. Iris considers that the moral self is actually a result of a combination between ethics and aesthetics. I mentioned that before. And she was a student of Wittgenstein. Well, from Wittgenstein, she frequently quotes Wittgenstein, who said that ethics and aesthetics are but one. And I found that unique in her development of the moral subject. And Iris, being a Neoplatonist, is also, of course, a virtue ethicist. What I love most is that her main virtue that she encourages us to embrace is love. But it is a certain kind of love, which is not necessarily love, agapeic type of love. Agape,
right,
as we pronounce in Greek, in English. it's not that Christian type of love. It's a love which focused on aesthetic perception of the others, which is actually disengaged rationally and is completely disinterested. It's my analogy with the aesthetic perception of an object of art.
That's interesting that you're interested in a virtue ethicist, because I'd always associated virtue ethics with a religious grounding for ethics and utilitarianism with humanism. But I guess it's possible to believe in virtues without believing in God or the supernatural, isn't it?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Greeks did not necessarily believe in gods when they were focused from the development of beautiful character, right? And we have to remember what Socrates said, that virtue is knowledge of the good, and that good was not a transcendental good. Knowledge of the good in a sense of knowledge of what is the right deed, what is the right thing to do, what is the to be honest, to be charitable, to be given, to be loving, to be, and so on.
That's interesting. I've recently introduced some bioethicists to the writings of Mark Walker, who's a transhumanist bioethicist and a neo-Aristotelian. And he argues that what we should do is have a genetic virtue program where we identify the genetic underpinnings of the virtues, which he would include things like compassion, empathy, and maybe a moral steadfastness or something, and encourage people to tweak those genetic traits in their own minds. So,
would that be possible?
There is a lot of very interesting research on the genetic underpinnings of personality, and some of these characteristics, such as sociability and compassion, seem to have genetic roots. You know, at least insofar as there are extremes of human personality where people don't have those characteristics, like.
Yeah.
Like Asperger's and things like that. But anyway, that's a topic for another conversation. So,
yes. Yes.
Well, I want to really thank you for coming on today, Anna. And as I told you, I think that the work that you're doing at the UN is, it's so inspiring that there is a voice for our values at the UN, where a lot of these policy issues are going to be increasingly focused. So I wish you the best, and I hope that everyone gets to your conference. We'll be having information about the conference both on changesurfer.com and at transhumanism.org. And hopefully you're going to have a website up soon, or?
Well, we already posted the conference on the call for papers on www.iheu.org.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And also people can call me directly to inquire about that, 212-687-3324, or email me at annalita@iheu.org.
Okay. And Anna is, again, the director of the International Humanist and Ethical Union's Center for Bioethics at the United Nations. Thanks so much for joining us today, Anna.
IAGU. We need to say that. It's
right.
IAGU. Abignani Humanist Center for Bioethics.
Right. Acknowledge the very generous donor who set you up there. Thanks so much for joining us, Anna.
Thank you very much.
Our nation is struggling to defend a traditional biblical understanding of marriage, so I'd like to offer this constitutional amendment to defend biblical marriage in the United States. Marriage in the United States shall consist of a union between one man and one or more women. Genesis 29:17-28. Marriage shall not impede a man's right to take concubines in addition to his wife or wives. Samuel 5:13, 1 Kings 11:3, and 2 Chronicles 11:21. A marriage shall be considered valid only if the wife is a virgin. If the wife is not a virgin, she shall be executed. Deuteronomy 22:13-21. Marriage of a believer and an unbeliever shall be forbidden. Genesis 24:3. Since marriage is for life, neither this Constitution nor the Constitution of any state, nor any state or federal law, shall be construed to permit divorce. Deuteronomy 22:19. If a married man dies without children, his brother shall marry the widow. If he refuses to marry his brother's widow or deliberately does not give her children, he shall pay a fine of 1 shoe and be otherwise punished, in a manner to be determined by law. Genesis 38:6-10. On the basis of these biblical principles, I'm sure we can reestablish the sanctity of the American family. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.